Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, April Fool's Day. So no gimmicks today, I guess, huh? All right, so here we go. We have a number of hearings. My understanding, we have a couple of bills that are up that do not have the paperwork that's necessary. First thing I want to do is open a work session on Senate Bill 945 and just let everyone know that bill is going to continue to be carried over. We do not have the paperwork, so it's being carried over till tomorrow, which is Thursday, April 2nd, and we're going to close the work session on 945 until then. And at this point, Senator Walker, did you want to go ahead and get started on the SCR? All right, so we'll open a public hearing on SCR 11. And Council, why don't you give us an overview?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 11 will memorialize the life of James Klonowski, expresses condolences to his survivors and an appreciation of his life and his public service to Oregon and Lane County, and outlines his many personal and professional achievements. There's one proposed amendment, and we have fiscal and revenue impact statements, and there is no impact.
All right, so this bill is ready to move?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right.
One amendment.
All right, great. So, Senator Walker, you want to get us started?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here 2 days in a row. I'm so excited.
Tomorrow will be the hat trick.
Yeah. Well, Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and I am so excited to be here honoring my most favorite professor from the University of Oregon. I have to tell you, and I don't say that because his boys are sitting here with me. I say that because I was a scared kid from Reedsport High School who thought she would never be able to go to college. We were poor. My mother was divorced with four children with a deadbeat dad who didn't pay a stick of money in child support. And I had a high school counselor who was dying of Lou Gehrig's disease at the time. And he said, "You're going to college because I know you can make something out of your life." And so I said, "Okay, show me how to do it." And we applied for all these grants and scholarships that were available in the 70s. There was a lot of free money for poor kids then. And I got the opportunity to go to the U of O 4 years free of charge. I had to do work study and odd jobs, but I made it. And I have to tell you, I was scared to death. And my first class was American Government with James Klonowski. And he was scary. And why was he scary? Because he wanted you to be engaged. He would ask everyone in the class, he'd just point out somebody and say, "What do you think about this, Ms.?" And he knew our last name. He called you by your last name, Mr. Prozansky, Ms. Mahaffey, because I had my maiden name then. I got married a year later. And he wanted to know where you were from. And then he'd tell you about your community. And he was just incredible. And if you were reading the newspaper in his class, he'd ask you, "Why do you find that newspaper more important than my class?" And I was so scared that I went home during finals week, and he gave the list of questions, and there were about eight of them. And he said, "There will be two or three, I can't remember now, of these questions on the test." So I wrote answers for all eight of them. And I memorized every single answer. And when I got in there, I got my blue book, and I wrote them out, and I was done in 20 minutes, and I handed it in, and he says, "Are you sure you're done?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am done." And I gave him my blue book, and when I got it back, I got an A+, excellent, excellent, lots of comments on it, and I've never forgotten that. And every class I took, boys, I got an A. So with that being said, Jim touched the lives of so many people, and you and I saw that, Mr. Chair, when we went to the memorial service. And so his boys are here today, two of his boys, to talk about the achievements of their father and what he meant to them as well as to the rest of our state and across the nation. So I'll introduce Nick and Zach with me, and I think Nick is going to do the talking. So take it away.
All right. First of all, I'd just like to thank the committee for bringing this resolution before you today. Thank you to Chairman Prozansky, to Vice Chairman Boquist, and to the members of the committee and the committee staff. Oh, my name is Nicholas Klonowski, and it's an honor to appear before you today. I'd also especially like to thank Senator Vicky Walker for her efforts on this resolution. It means a great deal. If you don't mind me saying, though, I'd rather not be here today. I miss my dad very much. Not a day goes by that I don't think about how much I wish I could see him or hear his voice one more time. It's hard to believe I won't have the benefit of his advice in my life anymore. I'm comforted by the fact that he lived well into his 80s and impacted the lives of so many through his teaching. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis once said, "The most important political office is that of private citizen." My dad truly believed this. And though he was very proud to have served as a political science professor for 40 years and to have served as chairman of the Democratic Party of Oregon, I know that he took more pride in being an active citizen and participant in our great American democratic political experiment. He took it extremely seriously. Election day was sacred in our family, and getting involved in politics was a given. My brothers and I were going door to door with my dad from a very early age. In my case, even before I was one year old. This was a great warm-up for the years we spent delivering newspapers with our dad when we were teenagers. He just simply believed in reading the newspaper every day, and delivering the newspaper not only represented being an informed citizen, but also represented having a great work ethic, and that's something he wanted to pass on, not just to us, but anyone he taught. My dad never missed a day of reading the New York Times. I can't recall any day where he wasn't there reading the New York Times every day, cover to cover. He did his best to pass along what Justice Brandeis said to us, but also to every student he ever touched. I can't tell you how many people told me upon learning that I was Professor Klonowski's son what an incredible impact he had on their life and when he was teaching them at the University of Oregon. I can say without hesitation that my dad made the world a better place through his work. Along with President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who it just so happens my dad passed away on his birthday. This was his political hero growing up, and I don't think it's a coincidence that he passed away on his birthday. But along with Franklin D. Roosevelt, my dad's political hero was his fellow Minnesotan Vice President Hubert Humphrey. My dad was very proud to have worked on his 1960 campaign in West Virginia, and especially proud to have carried his part of West Virginia for Hubert Humphrey, despite having to deal with political tactics by the Kennedy clan that were pretty difficult to combat. Humphrey earned the nickname the Happy Warrior for his consistently cheerful and upbeat demeanor that went along with his forceful advocacy of liberal causes. And I would say that nickname would also apply just as easily to my father. My dad fought hard for what he believed in and never backed down from a fight. But he did so while maintaining a friendly disposition and a great sense of humor. I'm sure if he were here today, he would say, "The Oregon legislature is honoring me. It must be April Fool's Day." I'm not one for long speeches, so I don't want to get into the personal stories about my dad. So I'd just like to close by saying that the greatest thing about my dad is that he never forgot where he came from. He always remained that kid who grew up on the Iron Range in northern Minnesota during the Great Depression. No matter how much success he had in life, he never forgot about the kind of people he grew up with, and he never stopped fighting to make their lives better. I hope he can rest in peace knowing what a great impact he had on the lives of so many people. One last thing. I know that the times are tough and the state is having to make a huge amount of cuts in the budget, but I know my dad would want me to urge you to keep funding our public education system at very good levels. Aim high for our kids and trust the people of Oregon to support you on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions? Any comments? Boys, thank you very, very much for being here.
Thank you.
And your dad would be very proud of you.
Thank you.
So, Senator Walker, any closing comments?
Ms. Chair, it just brings tears to my eyes thinking about all these wonderful things, and it was great being at the service and hearing the stories the boys had to tell about the newspaper. I remember that newspaper story with all of them flying out the back of the van, and of course, their dad would never blame himself for not shutting the van door when they went down the highway, but the newspapers went flying. And how many did you recover, Nick?
All but 10
newspapers. And his dad had a favorite phrase, but we won't say that.
That's somewhat of profane.
As an old paper boy myself, you know, when you came up short, you just went to the box and took a few more to make sure that...
Yeah, we never had to explain why we came up short that day when they all flew out the back, but we were only 10 short, so it didn't seem like it was that big a deal.
Well, it has been an honor, Mr. Chair, to know the family. I've not known the boys as well as their father and their mother. It's been a delight. Their mother is a federal judge in Eugene, and I worked in the same building, so we would have lots of conversations. And over the years in my political career, Jim would call me on the phone, and we'd have conversations about the state of the world and politics in Oregon. And I've never forgotten the start he gave me to know that I could be somebody, that I was smart, because I didn't feel very smart coming from a little tiny town. But he always told you to look inside for the strength you need to do what you need to do for your community. And he gave back to our community over and over again. The Dash 2 amendment, I will just speak to very quickly. Nick and Zach's brother Jake wanted to add the piece about the Iron Range, because that was pretty important. That was a part of Minnesota he grew up. And then their sister Catherine's name is spelled with an E. So those are the only two small amendments, and we'd be proud for you to pass this out today.
That would be great. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Nick and Zach for being here, and thank you, Senator Walker, for bringing this forward. I got up this morning and opened up the Oregonian, and there was an editorial called In a Simple Question, a Lasting Legacy. And so I didn't write the date on the top, but this was in this morning's Oregonian, and I encourage everyone to read it, because I do believe that that your father, Nick and Zach, will be a lasting legacy, and we'll continue to hear stories about people whose lives were influenced by him. So thank you for being here, and thank you, Senator Walker, for bringing this
forward.
Thank you. All right, any other comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. And is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on SCR 11? Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on SCR 11, open up a work session on SCR 11.
Chair, move the Dash 2 into SCR 11.
Senator Boquist moves the Dash 2s into SCR 11. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move the SCR 11 as amended to the floor with a motion to pass it.
Senator Boquist,
Do adopt.
Senator Boquist moves SCR 11 as amended by the Dash 2s to the floor with a do adopt motion. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Walker, you'll be our primary carrier on this one, if that's all right.
I expect you to have a lot of time to say it.
Thank you very much. And we're going to go ahead and close the work session on SCR 11 and change counsel. So I'm going to go ahead and open up. We have this scheduled as a work session on Senate Bill 385, and I'm going to open up that work session with the understanding that we're going to have some additional discussions. And so, Council, once you walk...
Chair, members of the committee, the amendments before you are basically the bill. It creates a pilot program to fund resource centers in Multnomah, Lane, Marion, and Jackson counties with one additional resource center in Eastern Oregon, requiring the Department of Corrections to make grants to fund these resource centers. Requires the centers to provide, among other things, alcohol, drug assessment, and treatment assessment, planning, housing, employment, and financial and computer literacy training to persons released from the Department of Corrections. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is an evidence-based program.
All right. And let's see, did we have others that we can call for?
I think Mr. Shepard is here and has a series of people. A judge from Boston.
All right. Ross, why don't you come forward? I'm not sure if you have a panel that you want to bring with you.
Uncle wrote too.
Yeah, I didn't know what the order was going to be.
Good morning, Chairman Brzozowski and members of this committee. Senate Bill, you're dealing this morning with the Dash 3 amendments, and the bill is entirely incorporated within those amendments. And these were prepared with the substantial assistance of my colleague, Dr. Harpelrode, and we think the bill is in proper order for the committee to consider it. As Mr. Taylor has briefly explained to you, this bill establishes by grants from the Department of Corrections resource centers designed to provide services for successful reentry to society following release from prison. There are five sites established with the Department of Corrections to make some determination about the appropriate part of the state in eastern Oregon. There are 15 types of assistance that are listed in the bill that need to be either readily available at the one-stop center or by streamlined referral. The Dash 3 amendments added education and community colleges to the list, which were inadvertently left off in the first draft. And as has been noted, all of these types of resources and assistance have been shown by evidence-based studies to ameliorate the difficulties that these folks leaving prison encounter. It does mandate a cooperation from all the various parts of the criminal justice system within the community. It prohibits any activity that would hinder full cooperation with the federal government, and I suggest to you that in the future that's going to play out to be a significant part of this bill. And finally, it establishes a rigorous protocol for testing the effectiveness of these programs. I would like to thank the committee and Mr. Taylor especially for the assistance and cooperation that I've been shown during this process. It really has been a pleasure, and this appears to be a good idea whose time has come. I'd like to further remark that it is thoroughly appropriate that this morning this committee heard SCR 11 memorializing James Klonowski. As you all know, he is the husband of presiding federal judge Ann Aiken. And she has organized, and what I wish to impart to you is that this bill is fully consonant with the ideas and hopes that he espoused, and I suspect he's smiling on this hearing today. I would like to introduce to you Judge Leo Sorokin, who is magistrate judge from the Eastern District of Massachusetts, Boston. He is here for a conference that has been in very large part coordinated by Judge Aiken that will happen in Portland tomorrow and Friday. And this will be at the what we think will be the one-stop resource center for Multnomah County. It is the old Calvary Christian Church, which actually was initially the first YMCA in Portland. And it has incredible potential to help and indeed change lives. So Judge Sorokin has made good solid contact with Judge Aiken. He has been filled in, I hope, pretty well of what Oregon's thoughts and ambitions are. And I think the committee would benefit from hearing briefly from him.
All right, thank you. Judge Sorokin.
Good morning. My name is Leo Sorokin. Ross said I'm a magistrate judge at the federal court in Boston. I came out to Oregon not to be here this morning, but to really learn, ostensibly because Judge Aiken invited me to speak at this reentry conference about some of the work that I've been doing at the federal court in Boston, running what we term loosely a reentry drug court. But really, I came out, I tell you at the outset, to learn from people in Oregon, because Judge Aiken and I have met a number of times at different judicial conferences over the past several years, and what she's been doing here is, frankly, the conference was an opportunity for me to come to Oregon so I could do what I really want to do, which was learn from what she's doing here, because I think that both in the the federal system, and my understanding is in the state system, a lot of innovative things have been done here in Oregon that I think a lot of people could benefit from. And so I wanted to sort of thank all of you and recognize that role that people in Oregon have been playing. Judge Aiken's been a leader on many of these reentry issues. Because I know your time is limited, to sort of cut to the chase, what seems to me particularly significant in the reentry world, if you will, and what I see in the federal system is that we tend to have many of us in the criminal justice system, a conventional view of the issues, that there's either tough on crime or rehabilitation. And I think that what's significant about reentry is you realize that public safety, which is really the number one priority and the purpose of the criminal justice system, to make our neighborhoods and our communities safe, is promoted when the people who are some of the greatest risk to public safety, those people who are coming out of prison, are on the one hand given an opportunity and given a helping hand to succeed, because it's our vested interest to see them, what our mantra and our program is, sober, employed, and law-abiding. That it's for the benefit of the community that the people who are coming out of federal prison and been here, state prison, are sober and maintain their sobriety, are employed and maintain a job if one is available in the present economy, and that they comply both with their conditions of probation and the law. And the way that's accomplished, I think, is in part by coordinating, working together. But it sounds like this bill, from looking at it, attempts to promote us on a larger scale, in a sense, what's done in many of these reentry court programs, which is where the prosecutor, the defense attorney, the probation office, social service agencies in the community, and the court come together in an attempt to work together to give the, on the one hand, the defendant the opportunity to succeed, help the defendant overcome the problems and obstacles they face, and on the other hand, ask something of the defendant, which is something we don't always do in the criminal justice system, and that is ask and expect and hold this person accountable for their behavior. That, you know what, you're going to have to be sober, employed, and law-abiding, and we know you have a drug problem, and you're going to need to go to treatment, and we understand you may relapse, but it's not a free pass. And so this bill sounds like what it does is promote both the cooperation among all the people in the system who often talk to each other but aren't always working all together, and focusing on a common objective, which I think everybody agrees is in our interest, which is helping people succeed the way probably all the people in this room are succeeding, paying their bills, complying with the law, holding a job, meeting their obligations to their family and to other people in the community. I don't know if you had specific questions that you wanted me to answer, but or if I could share other experiences with what we've done in Boston, I'd be happy to do that. But whatever would be helpful to all of you.
Well, let me just see if there's questions or comments from anyone here on the panel. Senator Boquist first, and I'll come back with a couple.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ross, just kind of want to reconfirm, I just read through the dash threes here, and you and I have discussed in my office several times. I mean, the long-term goal here is to consolidate services and reduce recidivism, and on my side of the aisle, let's reduce expenses and, yes, and costs, and we think that's the direction it's going. The other comment that I would make is that in listing, you listed four counties, and obviously we want to ensure that there's been discussions with these counties, and this is kind of willing participants in this experiment, for a better word.
Mr. Chair.
We'll let them comment.
We can't see your nod. We can't hear your nod.
Well, thank you. In Multnomah County, Mercy Corps has been involved in organizing the ROAR project, which brings together some 44 nonprofit organizations, and in cooperation with the public safety system in Multnomah County, those are willing participants, willing and ready and able. In Marion County, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul has an already running, existing, functioning program and fit very well into the definitions of this statute. In Lane County, you have all heard of Sponsors Incorporated, a nonprofit that provides transitional housing for folks being released from prison. It's the only facility of the sort in the state. In Jackson County, the federal Office of Parole and Probation has taken the initiative of developing the community there, and I think that will add an interesting part of the mix of how these services can be provided. And then in Eastern Oregon, I think we're still trying to figure out where this might most likely be situated. One would tend to emphasize the population centers just to make sure that we are serving the most number of these parolees that we can. But the counties listed, including Eastern Oregon, will comprise some 75% of all of the folks leaving Oregon prisons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitsett.
Shepard, our Department of Corrections is looking at, as all the agencies are, a 30% reduction in funding. That is about $400 million for the Department of Corrections. How would this program, pilot program, be funded, and at expense of what other programs would it be funded? I think this is a good program, but I mean, we're looking at creating a new program here, and in a situation where there is no money, and to actually continue current programs. So could you give us some ideas, your thoughts on that?
I think all I can do is give ideas at this point, Senator. It is the question of the day, though. The matter will be sent to Ways and Means, and of course there will be a necessity of state money. It is my hope, though, that there will be, through a collaboration with the United States government, we will be able to tap into funds that would help operate these resource centers. The idea is that the United States government is the largest correction system in the United States. They have imprisoned some 200,000 people, and 1,000 of those get out in Oregon every year. So the idea there is that these resource centers provide the very same services to our state prisoners that these federal prisoners need. There's really no difference in what is required for a successful reentry. So I think what I'm trying to tell you is that I hope that there is a combination of funding sources. Mercy Corps is applying to United Way, I believe. I may make a mistake here, but this is for a rather large grant, and the passage of this bill, I think, will help the securing of those funds. A long way of saying, I think that there are many funding sources other than having to cut Oregon programs to find money to do this. In the process of going through the Department of Corrections budget, it may be that it is determined that money spent here, a smaller money spent here, may actually have a much larger bang for the buck than how it's currently being spent inside the prisons.
Let me interject, if I could. In my discussion with Judge Aikens, that there may be a combination of three different sources of money. One would be state leverage money, or money to leverage with the federal grants that could potentially be available. Understand, and I condition that because I understand all of that's in flux. But there is that opportunity, and as Ross Shepard has said, understand that some of these organizations are looking at some, I'm going to call it more private partnership type of money that would be coming from the community. It may be nonprofit oriented, or it could be including some of the businesses. I understand that there are some various think tanks, philosophy organizations that are actually looking to try to set up some models. And from my understanding, there's no commitments yet. It's everything's still kind of in that gray area, but it does seem there's a lot of interest. And so the goal here is for us to move this forward and allow Ways and Means to have it in their possession, and then hopefully we'll be able to see what the various partners or players could be, and what participation and they would have financially as well. And this brings me to the question, Senator Whitsett, did you have another question? Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, Judge, if you could just maybe tell us a little bit about your experiences in Boston. I've heard from Judge Aikens that you've done some wonderful work there and setting some parameters of really trying to get people to realize that it's in our best interest when people do come out that they are going to be successful, knowing that we may have to help them on the way, but at the same time, if we can get them to be paying taxes, we all are winners.
Yes, that's certainly true, especially in this day and age. What we've done in the federal system is, as you probably know, somebody who's convicted of a crime goes to jail, and after jail they're on what we call supervised release. It's merely a probation after jail. And essentially what we've done is with that group of people, so they're federal prisons coming back to our community in Massachusetts, they've served their prison sentence, they're under the court's, the probation office's supervision, which is part of the court. The old model, or the existing model, was for people who the probation office would work with someone when they had a problem, and by problem I mean they didn't go to their treatment, they didn't do what they were supposed to do, they didn't pay their restitution, they tested positive for drugs. The probation office would work with them, and at some point in time they would bring them back before Judge Aiken's equivalence in Boston and ask that they be sent back to jail. And then that would typically occur to some degree, and then we would start all over again, and they'd be back on probation after. And it was, a sense, a little mini revolving door after the jail sentence. And what we decided was that, especially with the people who are the most difficult, so our program is focused really on the people in the federal system in Boston who are the most difficult substance abusers who are coming out of jail. In our community, it's typically heroin and cocaine addicts. We don't have as much of a methamphetamine problem in Massachusetts as you appear to have. And so we decided that we could take the authority of the court, and instead of looking backwards only at adjudicating what happened in the past, if we could use the authority of the court to promote, and our mantra is to create and maintain a sober, employed, and law-abiding life. If we could use the authority of the court to do that. So we take roughly the same services that were available in any event, but we review. I see the people as frequently as every week, and if they're doing well, great, we encourage them, because some people need, and Senator Walker, I heard, testify at the prior bill, and she talked about the power that Judge Aiken's husband had as a positive influence in her life, and the power of that guidance counselor who said to her, you can succeed. And I think we all know the power of a mentor in somebody's life, and sadly many of the people coming to the criminal justice system never had that, and they never had anybody tell them that they could succeed. Now, they need more than somebody telling them they could succeed. But the second piece of it is we hold them accountable for their behavior. We connect them with all the different services, and then we expect them to succeed. We set the bar high, if you will. If you ever saw the movie Stand and Deliver, I think it's called, it's about a math teacher in Los Angeles who went to a remedial math class in the high school, taught calculus, and he succeeded, and they passed the AP calculus test. Now, the people at Princeton didn't believe him and made them take it again, and they passed it again. And that sort of represents kind of the obstacles people have, but we have found that, not with everybody, I wish we could succeed with everybody, we haven't succeeded with everyone, but we have found that taking these people with long criminal records, that if we tell them that they're going to succeed, we expect them to succeed, we hold them accountable for their success and their failures, step by step, and show them the way, that they do. And we're succeeding to a substantially better degree in the program with the people coming in than people who aren't. And it's a combination of services and accountability. So that's what we're attempting to do, and what I think is significant about it is we're focused on success. Right. It's a different role for a judge. It's a different role for everybody in the system, but it's also a role that enables everybody to come together and work together. Because you know what? Many of the defendants, they don't really want to go back to jail. They don't necessarily know how to behave in a way that will prevent them from going back to jail, but they're willing to go in that direction if somebody will, on the one hand, point them in the right direction for some school or some job training or an opportunity to get a job. And they also need often a little bit of coercive authority to succeed. I mean, sometimes I've told people, you know what, you have to get a job now. It's enough looking for a job. I'm not really interested in you looking. I'm interested if you have a job. So get a job or do full-time community service. That's been a powerful motivator to find what law there is. We're a little bit more fortunate than in the last 24 hours of the economy here, where we are, our economy is suffering greatly, but they're perhaps not as badly as you are. So some people are finding jobs. So I think it's that focus on success and that bringing together of course of authority and asking yourself what works, because success is what's important. And I think actually to Senator Boquist, to your point, that related to your question. One of the, I know that we enjoy in the federal system a luxury of resources compared to the state system. But we too, as hard as it may be to believe, suffer from some budgetary problems of our own, not as acute perhaps as what you endure. And one of the reasons when we started out on this is that one of the things that we were trying to do was actually save money. Because one of the things we found, one of the things that federal probation pays for people coming out of prison who are indigent, is drug treatment. And one of the things we were finding is treatment can be expensive. And we were sending people to treatment, they would do well in treatment, but then what would happen is after a period of time, they stop going to treatment. And then they relapse. And then we would finally, the court intervene, and they'd be sent to jail for a period of time, and then they're coming out, and we would have to start all over again. And in a sense, we took all that money we spent on that drug treatment, and it was like those newspapers that went out of the back of the van, except that we couldn't drive back over the road and pick them up. It was all gone. And so what we're trying to do is reap the reward from the treatment dollars that we've invested. By when people go to treatment, we expect them to stay in treatment. So and typically what we find is that people don't fall off a cliff like that all at once. The problem begins when they stop going to a treatment session or two, or different problems develop. And if you closely monitoring and you intervene, you can get them back on track and you haven't wasted those dollars. And so I don't have a formal study to show you, but anecdotally, our probation chief, who monitors his budget, obviously, believes that we're saving treatment dollars in this, because we don't want to have to spend a dollar twice. We don't want to have to do it again. And so we're doing a little less of that. And so I'm not sure if this bill necessarily accomplishes that, but I think you're moving in the direction to try to reap the benefit of that. And in a sense, you want to reap the benefit to the extent you can of the money you spend on somebody in prison.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 385? Not hearing anyone coming forward. We're in a work session, and so I'm going to ask members, we could adopt the Dash 3s. We do not have the paperwork to actually move the bill forward. And if y'all are ready to do the Dash 3s, we can do that. If not, we can wait until we get the fiscal stuff back. So
we'll just move the Dash 3s, and then we'll wait for the fiscal.
Mm-hmm. That's fine with me.
That way it's very clear to LFO what we're doing.
Right, the intention and all that.
Mr. Chair, we're in work session. We're in it.
We are.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 into SB 250.
Dash 3.
Dash 3 into... Okay, I just read the wrong one. Okay, got it, whatever. Dash 3 is into 385.
Senate Bill Quest moves the Dash 3 is into Senate Bill 385. Is there any discussion?
I have a question. Is it clear that this is going to Ways and Means, or are we waiting for that determination?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my discussions with Tim Walker last night, that it fiscal is significant. But what he was waiting for was more detail from one of the agencies as it relates to exactly what would... went into the fiscal.
So the answer is yes.
So it will definitely be going to Ways and Means. Any other comments or questions? Any objection to the Dash 3s being adopted into SB 385? Not seeing any, so ordered. And we're going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 385. And I'm going to carry this one over to tomorrow, or do we have any time framers to win? So we want to post it.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be fine to carry it on to tomorrow, and hopefully the fiscal will be there. So I thought that we'd have it by now.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and carry over Senate Bill 385 until tomorrow, see if we get the fiscal. That way we don't have to worry about reposting it if it's here. If not, then we can carry it over to Monday and expect that it will be there by then. So 385 will be carried over till tomorrow to see if we get the paperwork. And I'm going to go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 253. And Council, give us an update.
Chair, members of the committee, you have the Dash 2 amendments in front of you, and they basically replace the bill except for Section 2, which basically in that provision says that the provisions were also in the juvenile code. And I think it probably be best to go through the amendment, starting probably in page 4, the last section, because what this does, it says what part of the bill, when it takes effect, and it says, for example, Section 1, by Section 2 of this apply to custodial interviews conducted on or after July 1, 2011. Now, let me go back to the first part of the bill, because we have two sections of the bill, two applicability dates, both applying to statements, but to different groups. Section 1, a custodial interview conducted by a law enforcement agency in a law enforcement facility. You may remember discussions at the hearing about that. Concerns about statements made in a police cruiser or made on the street. So as we move on, you'll see a definition for law enforcement facility. If the interview is conducted in connection with an investigation into a person felony. As it relates to this part, person felony, this will take effect on July 1, 2011. When we move further down through the bill, you will come issues relating juveniles and people who do not speak English, and that's over on Section 3, and where there's a murder investigation, statements that will need to be recorded January 1 of 2010. So going back to the first page, Subsection 2 states does not apply to a statement made before a grand jury, statement made on the record in open court, a custodial interview conducted in another state within compliance with the state laws of that state, a custodial interview conducted by federal law enforcement in compliance with federal law, a statement that is spontaneously volunteered and did not result from a custodial interview. This is new. Dear members of the committee, this was not in the original bill. And as you know, we had a work group. We went through these. These are some suggestions that law enforcement made to the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm not going to say that law enforcement is signing off on this bill. They're not. But these are suggestions that were made and were incorporated in the bill. A custodial interview for which the state demonstrates good cause for the failure to electronically record the interview. That's defined later. If the state offers an unrecorded statement under the circumstances described in subsection 1 in a criminal proceeding alleging the commission of person felony, and the state is unable to demonstrate by preponderance the evidence that the exception subject to applies upon the request of the defendant, the court shall instruct the jury regarding the legal requirements in subsection 1 of this section and the superior reliability of electronic recording when compared with testimony about what was said and done. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may remember in the original bill, it would have been grounds for suppression. This is a change, again, that came as a result of discussion. For law enforcement agency that creates an electronic recording of custodial interview shall preserve the recording until the defendant's conviction for the offense is final or all direct and post-conviction relief and habeas corpus or appeals are exhausted. That's a carryover. The state shall provide an electronic copy of the defendant's recording, et cetera. And then on line 15, the state is not required to provide the defendant with a written transcript of the contents of the recorded statement. That's a new addition. So all I have to supply is the electronic recording, nothing, no transcript. Transcripts can oftentimes be expensive. As used in the section, now we're into what custodial interview means, questioning by a law enforcement officer that requires the officer to advise the person being interviewed or the person's constitutional rights, the Miranda warning. So one of the questions before, one of the problems came up before was, when does a custodial interview start? Here you have a clear, bright line. As soon as they say you have a right to remain silent, et cetera, under this bill you would have to record the statements made thereafter.
But also with a caveat as to where the location of where those Miranda's giving out in the field, my understanding from what you described
that's
on
correct,
the first page
Mr.
would not apply.
That's correct. And as we move forward, you will see the definition for a law enforcement, was it a next page, it's
I got it, yeah, page three.
Law enforcement page. Facility. On good cause includes situations in which the defendant refused to have the custodial interview electronically recorded. Failure to electronically record the custodial interview was the result of equipment failure. And we had a demonstration of that, Mr. Chairman, as the committee of that.
Yes, we did.
Hearing. And a replacement device was not immediately available, or the law enforcement officer operating the equipment believed in good faith the equipment was operating properly. Electronically recording the custodial interview would jeopardize the safety of any person or the identity of a confidential informant. Then it goes on about exigent circumstances, prevented the recording of the custodian view, or the law enforcement officer conducting you reasonably believed at the time the interview began that the interview was conducted in connection with a crime other than a personal felony. So if it started off as a, as chair members of the committee, as a property crime of theft, and then this person started making statements, as they oftentimes do as it relates to other crimes. Now, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we now define law enforcement facility means a courthouse or a building or premises that is a place of operation for a municipal police department, county sheriff's office, or other law enforcement agency at which the person may be detained in connection with a juvenile petition or a criminal charge. It then goes on to define person felony is defined by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, which they do for purposes of sentence, determining sentencing guideline sentences. Then, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we now get into the second part of the bill, and this applies if the person being interviewed is a minor who is subsequently charged with or alleged to have committed an act that, if committed by an adult, would constitute a person felony. Once again, that would go back to the definition of person felony above. A non-native English speaker who requires the services of a translator or interpreter and is subsequently charged with a person felony. And then C, the state is enabled by preponderance of basically someone charged with murder. And it's, the wording is had to be worked here in Massage because sometimes murder is not charged right away.
Okay.
But what happens is it takes, you know, the old common law rule of you cause the result of someone's death within a year and a day. So injury could result, and then 3 months later the person dies in the hospital. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those are basically the dash two amendments.
All right, let me tell you where the chair is on this. We just got these, I think, were issued yesterday. This is the first for the chair to hear of them. I'm not sure if anyone else has had an opportunity. I would like to just carry this one over. I don't want to bring this into the bill at this point. I want all of us to have an opportunity because pretty significant, let's say, changes that are here, and I'd like to make certain everyone has an opportunity, including myself, to understand what the dash twos are, and we can take that up at another time. So let me ask, is there any questions of the council at this point regarding the dash twos? Senator Dinkfelder.
I have a question. I'm not sure if council can answer this, or you were there for the work group, correct?
Chairman's committee, Senator Dinkfelder, yes, I was there for both work groups.
So my question has to do with the exemptions for the custodial interview. I guess the question I had, given the testimony we heard on the initial bill, was there a discussion about what percentage, by allowing all these exemptions, and what percentage of the custodial interviews would still be recorded? In other words, if it's not going to be in a vehicle, you know, I don't have a sense about how many custodial interviews are conducted in the
facilities
versus in a vehicle or other areas. And I don't know if there was discussion about that. So we have a sense of what percentage of custodial interviews would be covered in this bill.
Let me take a stab at that. It's going to be anecdotal, but I would say there's many interviews that actually do occur at what would be defined as a law enforcement facility. I mean, clearly, if you're out in the field and something's ongoing, there will be interviews going on just trying to figure out what's going on. It may ripen into a more custodial type of arrangement, but for the most part, from my perspective, and if you wanted me to ask a few other people to come forward, I would say that a significant number are done within a facility that would be considered a law enforcement facility.
I would like to hear from the folks who are on the work group.
I'm going to just looking out here and see if Doug Harker will be willing to come forward as the former district attorney for Lane County as to his perspective as to how many. I mean, this is all going to be anecdotal, but I think he may be able to give you, you know, maybe some comfort of how much actually happens in the field versus how much actually, because there's a lot of times where people are, arrangements are made, people come in. I know for the two departments that I do my prosecution work for, it's not uncommon for meetings to be set up and people actually coming to the police facility to be interviewed.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired district attorney from Lane County. I spent 34 years prosecuting cases. and managing the DA's office for 24 years. There is, I'm confident, no statistics on this particular question, Senator Dingfelder. But what I would tell you is that police officers like to use their police stations for those interviews. They're set up to do that. They build interview rooms, and they do it a lot. It's a place where they can control the environment. They can control the individual, and it's safer for everybody to do those interviews. So there are lots of them done in police departments. Criminal investigations happen all over the state in all different places, and so if it's necessary to do an interview in their patrol car, they do it, or in somebody's home, they do it. They'll talk to people wherever they are. So it just happens every day all around the state, lots of places. And the police department is certainly one of them. The kind of cases that this bill mentions, and by the way, I was not on the work group, so I don't know what those discussions were. But this only applies to real serious person crimes. And those are the kinds of cases where somebody is going to get arrested and actually taken to the police station rather than do an interview and a citation to appear, and they move on, and nobody ever goes to the police station.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. That answers my question.
Counsel, and then Gail Meyer is also here. I don't know, Gail, if you wanted to come forward and try to respond to that question.
Chair, members of the committee, Senator Dingfelder, we did not specifically discuss the percentages, but I got the distinct impression from the defense community that was represented by not only Gail Myers but a couple other attorneys, that they were satisfied that there would be that the majority of these interviews would be conducted in the police station, and that the interests of clear and concise testimony being recorded would be advanced.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. As to percentages, I really can't speak with that. I would agree with what I heard from Mr. Harkelrode that this bill applies to the serious person felonies, and in those instances, I think it is more common. My understanding and perspective is it's more common for the officers to bring the individual to the facility for those interviews because it is a more serious case. I would say that we're not attempting to control or restrain the officer's discretion on whether or not they want to interview in the field versus go to the facility. We're not trying to control that. If they make their decision in using their discretion that an interview in the field or in the police car is warranted, they're allowed to do that. We're only simply trying to reach those situations where they do go to the facility, they are in the room, it's serious now, this is a person felony, the pad and paper used to be out, taking notes, you're on the record, you're making statements, incriminating yourself, or not. We're only attempting to reach those circumstances.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Senator Boquist.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question of counsel. If you recall, when we first started this bill, the Chief Justice and our honorary dear representative on the FAR Chamber of the Opposite Committee came and testified in favor of the original bill. Have they been provided copies of the Dash 2, and do we have any comments back from either the Chief Justice?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they have not. We just received the amendments about 3-4 o'clock yesterday.
Thank you.
I'm more than happy to send them copies, but
I think that'd be wise to do. And I know that I'll be meeting in my regular scheduled meeting with the chair of the House Judiciary tomorrow, and so that might be a good opportunity for me to check in with him after he has a chance to get the amendments and maybe make contact that he needs to make.
Comment, Chair Prasowski. I have been sending copies of our proposed changes to Nancy Cosine, who is the legislative representative for the Judiciary Department, but I cannot say that specifically it's gotten into the eyes of Chief Justice DeMunis. So.
All right, great. All right, with that, first thing before I close this, do it more formally. I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 253 till tomorrow, and knowing that we're waiting for the paperwork, and so members can have a chance to go through the Dash 2, so we may want to take that up tomorrow. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 253. And I did want to just let people know that if you hadn't seen in Sunday's parade magazine, there was an article that Senator Webb, I believe it was, who's a U.S. senator, had written regarding the state of affairs as it pertains to the federal system on incarceration. And so I meant to say that on the record when we had the other bill, but if you have access to that, you may want to just look at it to see what's happening on the federal level. That's somewhat different from ours as to knowing how many people are not only in custody, but what they're in custody for in the federal system versus the state system. So any other comments for the good of the order?
No, it's just at the risk of admitting that I do occasionally read Pride magazine. I did see that article, Mr. Chair. It is worthy of...
Yeah, it's one of those things that every once in a while you find yourself reading something you may not normally do. With that, we're going to close the Senate Judiciary Committee for today. We will be back tomorrow, and I believe our start time is scheduled at 8:30. With that, we're